I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. There are an estimated 30 million Kurds living in Iraq, Iran, Syria, Armenia, and Turkey. They're the fourth largest ethnic group in the Middle East, and while they've been promised nationhood in the past, it's never happened. They're now embroiled in various conflicts in the region and make up what has been called an alphabet soup of factions. There's the PKK, the PYD, the YPG, the YPJ, the KDP, the PUK, to name some of the major groups. We're going to make sense of those letters, talk about calls for independence and the role the U.S. has been playing in the region. President Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner is in Iraq, along with the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff meeting with the country's leaders. Interestingly, the Kurds in Iraq mostly like America, and many wanted Donald Trump to be our president. We asked Trudy Rubin and Brendan O'Leary to join us. Trudy just got back from a trip to the Kurdish region in northern Iraq. She was also in East Mosul, and she interviewed the head of the PYD in Brussels. She writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Trudy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Very good to be here.
Brendan O'Leary is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, has advised and will be advising the Kurds in Iraq on the Constitution and statehood. And Brendan O'Leary, it's been a long time. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be back, Marty.
And to our listeners, you can join the conversation in several different ways. You can text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Trudy, let me begin with you, but Brendan, I want to hear from you as well. There seems like there's so few countries that actually, or people that actually like America. Why are the Kurds pro-America, and why did they want Donald Trump to be our president?
Well, you know, if you look back at history, they might have reasons not to, since they've been betrayed in the past by the U.S., but we won't go there for the moment. The reason they like America is that basically the Kurdish autonomous region, the KRG, basically came into being because the Americans established a no-fly zone there in 1991, which they did rather inadvertently after President George W. Bush called on Iraqis to rise. The Kurds and the Shiites took him up on it. And then the U.S., after Saddam had been defeated in Kuwait, let him smash the Shiites and actually start to smash the Kurds, who fled by the hundreds of thousands to the mountains, between Iraq and Turkey. And it was a humanitarian disaster. And in order to enable those refugees to come back, the U.S. established a no-fly zone and basically said to Saddam Hussein, get out, stay out. And that,
and he did, largely?
And he did, because his military had been smashed. He had no air force except for the helicopters we allowed him to keep. And so we became, in effect, the protectors of northern Iraq. And during that period, although there were a lot of bumps on the road with various Kurdish factions fighting with each other in that space, but basically the no-fly zone enabled the Kurds to set up a de facto government. And at this point, they tried for a long time to go along with the U.S. insistence that they remain part of one Iraq. But they established their own institutions. And now, at this point, after the fight to get rid of ISIS, in which they played a very critical role and served as a base for all of the initial planning for the operation, they're hoping that at this point, because of disarray and what they feel is lack of cooperation and lack of constitutional behavior from Baghdad, they're hoping that the Americans will enable them to move further towards independence. And that's what they're banking on from Trump, seeing them as a loyal ally.
Well, let me put the Trump question to you, Brendan O'Leary. Why did they favor Donald Trump for president over Hillary Clinton?
not because of his domestic U.S. policies, but fundamentally because in the Kurdish perspective, Republicans have been in favor of intervention in Iraq and the removal of Saddam and have never apologized for the Iraq war. By contrast, Democrats are not seen as enthusiasts for the removal of Saddam. So they see it through a party prism. Any Republican would have been better regarded by the Kurds for this reason.
How does the U.S. then view the Kurds? Which is interesting because my understanding, Brennan, is that we don't necessarily support Kurdish statehood.
Well, I think Americans treat Kurds instrumentally and carelessly in general, though those Americans who've served in Iraq are generally extremely positive about Kurds. They've been the only reliable allies America has had in Iraq. They assisted militarily in the taking of Mosul and Kirkuk in the 2003 offensive. They have by and large gone along with American requests, except in insisting on their own constitutional rights. If they had listened to American advice, they would have been in a much more centralized and much more despotic Iraq than the one they happened to be in. So they have insisted on their own rights. And what was happening just about 2014 was that the constitution of Iraq had been so disgracefully not implemented by Baghdad that Kurds were getting ready to have their referendum. And then ISIS came along, which postponed the holding of a referendum, but that's now back on the agenda. And there will be a referendum on an independent Kurdistan. I confidently expect that to pass. And then the question will be, how will American diplomats and others respond to that?
Well, there is a referendum later this year, Trudy, let's say, and it looks like what you both are saying is that the Kurds will vote for independence. Does that mean they can leave Iraq? Is Iraq not going to put up a fight to hold on to this region of their country?
It's a very interesting question. Let me just interject one further point about why the Americans, more or less governments like the Kurds. Kurdistan is a more open society, while the population is often normally, traditionally religious, maybe yes, maybe no, but there's basically a more secular outlook on toleration of minorities. And for that reason, many Christians who escaped from Baghdad came up to Kurdistan. Minorities who fled from the fighting in northern Iraq came to Kurdistan. And although there's some tensions, basically Kurdistan is an open society. So I throw that in I think it's an important point. When you come to the referendum, I had a very interesting interview with Prime Minister Nechevan Barzani, who's the prime minister of the Kurdish government in the Kurdish region in the north. And what he said and what has been the position is that the referendum is not a declaration of independence.
Okay.
The referendum is to get the position of the Kurdish public on the record on this. The Kurds understand, and he underlined this, that if they're ever going to become independent, they have to have some kind of legal divorce from Baghdad because there are all kinds of issues that need to be settled. In the course of pushing ISIS out of northern Iraq, the Kurds recovered a lot of territory that they consider historically theirs, much of which is considered disputed by the Baghdad government. Some of that, as Brendan indicated, some of that the Kurds now say they will not give back, like the city of Kirkuk. But around the edges, on the margins, they would negotiate the boundary lines, which they'd have to do. There are things like air rights. There are things like trade and currency. But most of all, they have to have an economy.
Right.
They have to deal with oil. The oil has to go out somewhere. So either Turkey has to agree, and their relationship with Turkey is very interesting. We can go into that later. But they cannot be isolated and landlocked. They cannot do this against the wishes of all of their neighbors and Baghdad. And I think what they're counting on the Americans for, hopefully, but they are looking with a nervous eye at the way the Trump administration operates. What they're hoping for is that America will intermediate with Baghdad and balance Iran on their border, which has its own Kurdish problem and absolutely does not want independence.
So, Brandon, if we're talking about an independent Kurdistan, are we largely talking about Iraq, or are we talking about creating a separate country from Iraq, Iran, Syria, Turkey, and sort of cobbling together a country in the Middle East?
No, a greater Kurdistan is not on the agenda. We should think of this as the possible creation of South Kurdistan as an independent republic. So the Kurds of Iraq do have a very clear territorial conception of what an independent Kurdistan would look like, and they know that it would be vital for the success of winning recognition for independence, not simply from Baghdad, but from Iran and Turkey, that they confine their territorial claims to the space inside Iraq. They will indeed make it absolutely plain that they have no such territorial claims on any other part of the region. Now, that isn't to say they won't be sympathetic to the Kurds elsewhere.
Sure.
But the general line that they take is that they support a peaceful and democratic resolution of the Kurdish question in each of their neighbors.
Trudy mentioned oil, and I know there's oil that comes out of northern Iraq. And again, just trying to sort of understand the world that we live in. A candidate, Trump, talked about taking Iraqi oil. So I'm trying to understand why Kurds would support someone who talked about taking their oil.
He doesn't. They don't support that particular proposition. They do, however, insist that in the constitution of Iraq, in which I helped to advise them, that they won rights to develop their own oil fields that had not previously been exploited. And they also won the right to export their oil, and they have successfully built fresh pipelines to Turkey. One of the things that has happened is that the Baghdad government has not honored the constitutional settlement as regards natural resources. They failed to pay the Kurds what they owe them from previously jointly exploited fields. So these developments, these failures to pay the Kurds their due entitlements, are part and parcel of the background explanation for why the secession of Kurdistan is now inevitable.
We're almost up in a break here, but does the U.S. support, or does the Trump administration support independence for Kurdistan?
The Trump administration doesn't yet know what it wants to do, is the straight answer. But I think there are good reasons for believing that key people within the military and key people within the State Department know that the Kurdistan region would be as an independent state, would be a reliable ally, unlike Iraq, which is dominated by pro-Iranian Shia. And they also believe that an independent Kurdistan would balance against Iran. So if the major enemies of the Trump administration are ISIS and Iran, then it makes absolute intellectual and moral sense to be in favor of an independent Kurdistan, provided it can be viable and provided it doesn't trigger further conflict.
We have to take a very short break. Trudy, I know you want to say something. That's Brandon O'Leary, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, has advised and will be advising the Kurds in Iraq on the constitution and statehood. Also with us, Trudy Rubin, just got back from the Kurdish region in northern Iraq, also in East Mosul. She writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and we are talking about the Kurds in the Middle East. 267-405-2006. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Trudy Rubin and Brandon O'Leary about the Kurds in the Middle East. We've been focusing largely on Iraq. We're going to move on to Syria, also talk about Turkey, the Kurds living in a number of different countries in the Middle East and involved in many of the conflicts, including the fight against ISIS. And again, you can join our conversation, that comment line, that call-in line, 267-405-2006. Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I see a bunch of comments coming in here. Trudy, I know you wanted to add something. Let me just throw something out. Looking at all the various Kurdish groups, are they all fighting ISIS in one form or another when you look across the region?
Well, ISIS is an issue in Syria and Iraq.
Right.
And so the Kurds in both of those countries are key to the battle against ISIS. It's not an issue in Iran and in Turkey. There's a civil war between Turkey and the Kurdish rebel movement there,
the PKK.
So it's a different issue. The the Turkish government bills it as an issue versus terrorists. And we can talk about Turkey later, but there's some justification when talking about the PKK for using that term, but it's not an ISIS term. Right. And in fact, Turkey facilitated ISIS for a long time for its own reasons, let them move back and forth to Turkey.
Just underscoring how complicated all this stuff is. But if you look at Iraq and you look at Syria and you look at the Kurds are fighting ISIS.
Yes, and the Kurds are definitely, they're in the forefront with ISIS. And where the Kurds are also in the forefront is, as Masoud Barzani said last year in an interview that I did with him.
He's
the president of the government of the Kurdish region. The territorial makeup of the Middle East is up for grabs after the wars that have been going on in the last several years. And he was saying the old lines no longer hold. And I think where the Kurds are in the forefront is in possibilities of federalism in Syria, where the Syrian Kurds are calling for federalism and federal states within Syria, of which the Kurdish area would be one. And on the Iraqi side, I think what President Barzani talked about as one option is confederalism. A lot of people don't understand that term.
I don't understand that term.
Confederalism, yes, this is the man here, but confederalism is loose links between two independent states. So in a sense, it keeps the entity together at some levels. And perhaps this is a fallback on the Iraqi side, because after all, as Brendan O'Leary said, you have to have a viable state, and that means your oil has to get out. And for that, you either need the cooperation of Baghdad or of Turkey. And so, you know, it's a very fraught issue. On the Syrian side, the Kurds, I think, are in the forefront by proposing federalism, which is probably the only solution for keeping Syria from crumbling. But right now, the government in Damascus is against it, although the Russians seem to have some interest in it, at least where it affects the Kurds.
And I do want to move on to Syria, but let me give you a chance, Brendan, just to flesh out what Trudy just said.
So confederation is precisely defined as a political arrangement in which the member states have full sovereignty, including the right of secession.
Oh, okay.
So in a confederation, if it was a confederation of Kurdistan with Iraq, a two-unit entity, then it would be the case under that constitution that at any juncture, Kurdistan could be a sovereign and independent state. I would not require the cooperation or consent of Baghdad. Now, it's conceivable as a compromise outcome that if there were a referendum in which the Kurds voted to have sovereign independence, that they could then negotiate a confederal arrangement with the rest of Baghdad, replacing the existing federal constitution of Iraq, which has not worked. So here's the difficulty. It may well seem wise to Western policymakers, Americans and Europeans, that Syria should be reconstructed as a federation. They resisted initially reconstructing Iraq as a federation. And that federation has manifestly failed to work, at least in the way that Kurds had hoped and according to the pledges that were given. There's no real reason to believe, given the history of various Syrian parties, that they have any credible commitments or cultural dispositions towards making a federation work there either. But it is absolutely accurate, as Trudy has said, that the Kurds of Syria are promoting federal autonomy inside Syria. At the very moment that their co-ethnics in Iraq have despaired of federalism in Iraq. But interestingly, and this is important, inside the Kurdistan region, inside what would be a future sovereign state, there is extensive discussion taking place about the necessity for decentralization within Kurdistan, indeed possibly federalism within Kurdistan. If you think about it, it has four big cities, Sulaymaniyah, Duhok, Erbil and Kirkuk. Each of those is surrounded by a region that is dependent on those cities. Each has a different set of political configurations. It would make a great deal of sense for the independent or sovereign Kurdistan to be itself internally federalized.
I mean, this is a different kind of way of thinking about what it is to be. I mean, country probably isn't the right word to use what both of you are describing.
Right. Well, I think what you're seeing is this does not hark back, as some people said, to Sykes-Picot and the great powers divide. What this harks back to is once upon a time, there were empires. There was an Ottoman Empire in which there were all kinds of minorities who looked to Istanbul for protection. Now, the makeup that emerged after World War I and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire is cracking, but it is not enough to say states are over because you need an organizing principle.
Sure.
But what is lacking and what people are grasping for is how in the new dispensation do you protect these minorities? For example, the Yazidis who were slaughtered. The Christians. The Yazidis against whom a genocide was perpetrated by ISIS. And these minorities are frightened. Many feel they can never go home again. And in Iraq, many feel that whatever dispensation they live under, they have to have their own protected area with their own militia to protect them because nobody else did. Now, this is questionable. It's not clear whether that would provide protection. There's disputes even within the minority communities over whom they want to live under, Baghdad or the Kurds. The Yazidi community is split. So it's a very complicated, yeah. But what we're having is an attempt to figure out how to protect the complex ethnic fabric of the region from collapsing again into the kind of civil wars from which it hasn't yet emerged in this current round.
Well, let me move on to Syria, and Brendan, let me go back to you. So you have the PYD, that's the kind of political arm of the Kurds in Syria. You have the YPG, those are the, I guess, largely male fighters, I guess, fighting both, what, the government and also ISIS. And then you have the YPJ, which is either a militia or militias made up of women.
Just fighting ISIS.
Did I describe that semi-accurately there?
You did describe that accurately, but I would add an important qualifier.
Go ahead.
These three groups do not exhaust the Kurds of Syria. There are multiple other Kurdish parties who are actually more sympathetic to the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which is dominant in the neighboring part of Iraqi Kurdistan. So with that qualification, your description is accurate.
There is, and we hopefully might hook up with someone who, a Danish man who actually went to fight with the YPG. We're hoping to hook up with him. He is somewhere in Iraq. But if I can go back to you, Brendan, one of the appeals, at least for the YPG, is this sort of utopian Marxist, feminist, ecologist sort of, I don't know if it's a country within a country, but this vision for a certain part of Syria.
Right. So it's absolutely true that a certain section of the Western ultra-left sees in the Syrian Kurdish resistance movements all of the fantasies that they failed to achieve in their own pasts. So they like the possibility of seeing communal participatory government without formal statehood. They like the feminism of the Syrian Kurds, which is an outcome of their direct relationship with the PKK of Turkey.
Of Turkey.
Which insists on equal male and female participation at all ranks within the organization. So we have this bizarre world in which Western ultra-leftists are volunteering to fight in Syria against ISIS. And guess who their principal ally is?
The United great States of
Satan,
America.
Us, the great Satan of imperialism. So what is interesting, of course, is that people have a joint and agreed enemy, and that is ISIS.
And that is ISIS.
ISIS is a genocidal Islamist movement, which is wholly reactionary towards women, so it's completely understandable why there should be that kind of coalition.
Trudy, is there any way to know whether we, broadly speaking, are winning the war, the fight against ISIS? Do we have criteria for that?
Let me just say, because I was in the Kurdish region of Syria last year and interviewed the co-head of the PYD a couple of weeks ago.
That's the political arm.
Just a word more about their system of governance. I mean, it really is interesting. For one thing, women really do play a serious role, and the women leaders, both military and political, actually have power. I mean, this is not simply window dressing, as it is in many Arab parliaments where there's set-asides for women and they sit quietly in the background with maybe one or two exceptions who are Western educated. This is real power. It's also, they're tough. A lot of them fought years ago with Turkish Kurds in the mountains, and they're hardened and they're committed, and most of them are single and they're basically married to the job.
To the fight for
Kurdish federalism, which is a communitarianism, which is a philosophy that the originator of the Turkish rebel group, PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, got from Western philosophers in Vermont. I mean, it's a strange concoction, but I've seen it operate in which cities and towns set up communal councils, which ultimately are supposed to be elected. And what the Kurds are doing in Syria is, when they're moving into areas like Raqqa that are heavily Sunni Arab, in advance they're setting up civilian councils and future military councils that are comprised of Arab Sunni tribesmen from those areas. So the key is, I think, not simply whether we're winning the military battle against ISIS, which I think is on the way to happening, although it'll take a while longer, but whether there will be political structures afterwards to prevent the heavily Sunni areas from sinking back into support for some kind of jihadi group.
Go ahead, Brendan. I know you want to add to that.
So I think we shouldn't be overly impressed by the novelty of what's happening in the Syrian Kurdish areas. The pattern of creating councils is an historically well-established pattern on the left. We saw it in the Paris Commune. We saw it in the early stages of the Russian Revolution. The Soviet Union was a union of councils of this kind. And exactly the same question is posed in Syria. Is there behind, in the background, a single dominant party?
Right.
And I would say there still is. So there is a structure to the Syrian left, inside the Kurdish Syrian left, that is traditionally Marxist-Leninist. And that accounts for differences between that party and political configuration and their neighbors inside Iraqi Kurdistan, and indeed other Kurds inside Syria.
Let me ask you, I'll toss this back to you, Brendan, about the PKK. You both mentioned that. These are the Kurds in Turkey who have been fighting for, independence, I guess. They have been called, and I believe called by the United States, a terrorist organization. How should we understand the PKK?
The PKK, its translation in English is the Kurdistan Workers' Party. As its title suggests, it has a strongly Marxist-Leninist origin. And in the course of its history, if you define terrorism as deliberately killing civilians for political purposes, it has been a terrorist organization. It's not just that, of course. It's a symptom of the estrangement and alienation of Kurds from successive Turkish governments, which until roughly 15, 20 years ago, completely denied the Kurdish identity in Turkey. It had been militarily defeated by the end of the 1990s. It was in the course of successive negotiations with Turkish governments up until very recently. And what has happened very recently is partly as an outcome of what's been occurring in Syria, but partly as an outcome of President Erdogan's bid for greater power within the Turkish political system. There has been a reignition of the war between the government of Turkey and the PKK. And that war is extremely damaging, both for Turkish-Kurdish relations. It has spillover consequences for what's happening in Syria. And we won't really get a clear picture of what's going to happen in that area until the referendum occurs in Turkey.
In Turkey, another referendum.
Another referendum over whether or not President Erdogan is to be made a much more powerful presidential figure. Some might even call him a sultan. Now, if the outcome of that referendum is positive for Erdogan, he may feel sufficiently secure that he will become a more constructive participant in all of the neighborhood, including his own domestic questions. He could also, infused with extra power, prove to be completely unreasonable. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows the answer to that. Okay. And it's also possible, because I believe it's an open matter and I don't think this is closed, it's conceivable he could lose the referendum. Mm-hmm. And that, too, would have potentially significant consequences for further conflict.
Trudy, can I read? Here's an email from Avi, sort of related to what we're talking about. He says, is there a good reason for Turkey to fear an independent Kurdish state? Is there anything the U.S. could do to alleviate Turkish fears? About a minute before our second break here.
Turkey actually has a very good relationship with the Iraqi Kurds. It has basically... It's sort of bought Iraqi Kurdistan. It's their outlet for their oil pipeline. All of the construction is done by Turkish companies. They share intelligence. And for Turkey, Iraqi Kurdistan serves in a way as a buffer against its own Kurds because the PKK hides in the mountains on the border between Turkey and Iraq. And the Iraqi Kurds have not objected when Turkey went in, or at least maybe publicly they did, but privately not, to attack the PKK in those mountains when it deemed necessary. So you see the proof that Turkey can have decent relations with the Kurds.
Right.
And the verdict is out on whether it would see Iraqi Kurdistan as a plus for protection, buffing against its own Kurds, or whether it might see an independent Kurdistan as an inspiration for its own Kurds.
And that's Trudy Rubin. She writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer, just returned from a trip to Iraq. Also with us, Brendan O'Leary, also in Iraq in early March. He's a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. We are talking about the Kurds living in a number of key countries in the Middle East. And Brendan O'Leary will be and has been advising the Kurds in Iraq on the constitution and statehood. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Just a recap here. The turmoil in the Middle East, as we all know, is multifaceted, with shifting, sometimes conflicting alliances among the groups involved, governments, terrorists, including ISIS and rebels, vying for territory, for power, for autonomy. We've been focusing on largely the Kurds. This is an ethnic minority of about 30 million people living in parts of Syria, Iraq, Turkey, Iran, and they do fit weirdly and uniquely into the conflicts that are taking place across this region. And if you want to join our conversation, you can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. We're getting deeper and deeper into this complicated but such an important part of the world. Brendan, I know you wanted to say something more about Turkey.
I agree entirely with what Trudy said about the reasons why there are good relations between the government of Turkey and the Kurdistan Regional Government, particularly the Kurdistan Democratic Party. But there's also something that people are less aware of. The PKK, that is to say the originally Marxist-Leninist group in Turkey, which mm-hmm. has used terrorist violence, has also in the past attacked the Kurdish parties in Iraq. And at moments of potential dominance, they have been bullying and intimidatory towards the other Kurdish parties.
Why?
So there's because they are, in my view, monopolists. Right. They seek to monopolize the Kurdish cause.
They want to control the whole
thing. They want to control the whole show. That's their disposition. That's historically how they've behaved. And obviously that produces a reaction among other Kurds. So for this very reason, the government of Turkey could live contentedly with an independent or sovereign Kurdistan inside a confederation, knowing that that would be a space that was not dominated or significantly influenced by the PKK. And they would expect, as a reciprocal arrangement, as part of their recognition of Kurdish independence, that Kurdistan would become an ally against the PKK if it were to engage in violence against Turkey.
I just went, wow. Let me read a comment from David. Since the Kurds seem to be in several countries, would there be any incentives militarily or economically or otherwise that the international community could offer for each of these countries to give up a little territory for a Kurdish state? Would that the world was so simple, Trudy.
Yeah, I was just going to say, unfortunately, as we know through history, countries fight for their territory, and nobody is going to ask Turkey, for example, to give up the southeast of their country, which contains the water resources. And so it ain't going to happen, unfortunately, for the Kurds. This option, you know, died for a united Kurdistan, I think, back in Lausanne in 1923, I believe, when the Kurds, who had hoped, who had been promised a state out of the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, were basically stiffed, betrayed in the post-war dispensation. That doesn't mean that piece by piece something couldn't change. The best chance is in Iraq, clearly.
Right.
The chance in Syria, Russia has indicated that they would support a rewriting of the Syrian constitution to allow for autonomy, more autonomy for the Syrian Kurds. That's not a federal state. However, the Assad government opposes it, and Iran opposes it, which is critical in the post-ISIS makeup of Syria, since Iran is a major player and maybe even more major than Russia. But that future is question mark. I will say that Saleh Muslim, the co-chair of the Syrian Kurdish Party, the PYD, did say to me that he hopes that the U.S. will keep troops in Syria, in the Kurdish area, after ISIS is defeated. Clearly, he's thinking of a balancing factor. The Kurds always have to play all sides. History has taught them. So where Syria will go, I don't know. Iran is dead set against any independent Kurdistan or loss of territory.
How would Kurds in, let's say, northern, or how do they feel, Brendan, about a military base or military presence, U.S. military presence in their part of Iraq? Trudy's going, they love it.
Wholly enthusiastic.
Are they?
They would like to see a military base if that was possible. In answer to your listener, the Kurds have a metaphor. They refer to the four wolves. And those four wolves are Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. Now, they also have stereotypes about those wolves. Turkey is the big, clumsy, powerful wolf. Iran is the cunning, manipulative wolf. And Iraq and Syria are vicious wolves.
Wow.
And if we think about those metaphors, the two vicious wolves are now disabled. The Syrian state has been destroyed by civil war. That's not to say it couldn't revive, but it has been destroyed. The Iraqi state is a complete mess. With two of its principal units dominated by Sunni Arabs and Kurds in complete estrangement and alienation from the Baghdad government, except for temporary military purposes against ISIS. So we are going to see some kind of reconfiguration of those two spaces, the Iraqi and the Syrian space. By contrast, Iran and Turkey are very stable entities, powerful, unlikely to make major territorial concessions to their respective minorities. So it will be a very tough task for the Trump administration to decide what it's going to do constructively in those spaces. And we all await the outcome.
Well, Jared Kushner, along with the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they certainly were in Iraq yesterday. I believe, Trudy, they're still there today, talking with Iraqi leaders. I don't know if they're talking to Kurdish leaders or not. But what are they likely to hear?
I think, from what's being reported and perceptions. Kushner is there to handhold for Prime Minister Abadi, who was just in the United States, to try to emphasize that the U.S. is committed. But the question is, what is the U.S. committed to? Kushner has no knowledge of the complexities of Iraq. And the big question is, which the Kurds have been asking from before the Mosul offensive, is there a plan? Is there a plan in Baghdad for after ISIS is defeated? Does the United States have a plan? And the fact that Kushner would be sent there, sort of the young princeling who represents the man in the White House, but doesn't stand for a State Department that appears virtually disabled.
Well, has it even been there yet?
Hasn't been there, nor has the National Security Advisor been there. And James Mattis, retired General Mattis, who knows the region, has a lot on his plate at the Pentagon. So the question is, does the U.S. have a plan for more than military support in the fight against ISIS? Does it have a conception of what it wants for Iraqi Kurdistan? Or does it have the staying power to try to balance Iran, which is now embedded in the society of Iraq, in the politics, in the militias, the Shiite militias? And Kushner's presence does not offer any reassurance for those bigger questions, even if he handholds on the issue of American military support for the defeat of ISIS.
You want to weigh in on that? I noticed the two of you talk about what happens after ISIS is defeated, and I'm wondering, is it too soon to talk about that, or do you think
it's too soon to talk about ISIS being defeated in Mosul and in Raqqa, and thereby lacking any serious major urban locations where they're in power. But there will plainly remain a strongly mobilized Sunni Arab population in both Syria and Iraq, favorable towards jihadism. Kurds fear that if they don't strike for independence at this moment, that they will be pushed by international pressure, including from the U.S., back into one more bad marriage with Baghdad. And that's why, as well as their own internal difficulties, which I don't wish to underemphasize, that's what's pushing them forward towards going for independence. And precisely because there's a new administration in Washington which doesn't know what it wants to do, and only has two very clear principles. It's hostile to Iran, and it's hostile to ISIS. That's why Kurds think this is the political conjuncture to mobilize for the independence referendum. Once they have the backing of their people, then to begin to negotiate, both with Baghdad and with their neighbors, and indeed with the United States. If you think about it, no country ever seriously becomes independent by waiting for permission from all of its neighbors. The United States didn't become independent by asking Great Britain to become independent. My country of origin, Ireland, didn't become independent by asking Great Britain. The Kurds know that they have to make this strategic and psychological leap.
It
has military consequences, and they wouldn't be contemplating it if they weren't confident of their capabilities in that respect. Right. They have roughly 150,000 Peshmerga.
This is their militia or their fighting force.
It means those who face death. There are, in fact, three components, a joint force, and then two that are under the dominance of the two respective parties inside Kurdistan. They know that one of the things that they have to fear is that after, let's assume the defeat of ISIS takes place, they're not dealing with some coherent and well-organized Iraqi state in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're dealing with popular mobilization forces, as they're called, which are basically multiple militias of Shia origin, none of which are under the direct control of the of Prime Minister Abadi or others. So they want out of this bad arrangement, and they can't think of any good reason why anybody else should ask them to stay inside Iraq. And I'd like to hear a good argument for staying inside Iraq.
But what I heard over and over again, including from Prime Minister Nechevan Barzani, they have to have U.S. support on this. Because in order to function, in order to survive, there has to be some kind of arrangement with Baghdad. And also they need an arrangement with Turkey. But if they have neither of those, or even just Turkey, it simply, and if the Americans are against, then it simply won't work. President Barzani said to me last year, at least if the Americans are not against it, in other words, if the Americans were neutral. This year, I got the feeling that they really feel they need to convince the Americans it's in their interest. And I think two additional cards that they have to what Prendon said. One, if it becomes difficult to base American forces in Iraq proper because Iraq encourages its proxies, militias, to start attacking American forces, they could always base in the confederal state of Kurdistan. And second, Iraqi Kurdistan has no hostility towards Israel. And in fact, as everybody knows, there's an active intelligence operation. And so this is a carrot that they also hold out to the Americans.
I know you want to respond. I'm just curious, and I probably should have asked this almost an hour ago, Brendan. So are Kurds, are they Muslims?
Yes. Well, they're not wholly Muslim. Most of the Kurds everywhere are of Sunni Muslim disposition. There are Shiite Kurds. Historically, the Feli Kurds were Shiite. There are Yazidi Kurds. There are Christian Kurds, there are Mandean and Sabaean Kurds, and there are atheist and secular Kurds. So they have a full heterogeneous range, but the bulk of them historically are Sunni Muslim. There are some Islamist parties inside Kurdistan, and one of the things that America does need to think very carefully about is it should not assume that Kurdistan is permanently immune from forces elsewhere operative in the Middle East. Historically elsewhere, where nationalist parties have failed, where democratic movements have failed, where military dictatorships have failed, their successors have been militant Islamists. So if the West is serious about wanting to see the development of a democratic Kurdistan, it will have to take seriously the Kurds' bid for independence. Just to supplement what Trudy said, the Kurds of Iraq know that the best route to independence is successful negotiations with Baghdad to get recognition from Baghdad. What is interesting is that Baghdad leaders are not saying never.
And that's significant.
That is very important. And also, the Turkish government, President Erdogan's spokesman, only a few days ago, he too said it wasn't a question of never, but the timing wasn't right. Now, of course, it's always deeply inconvenient for others if a particular people and its leaders choose to embark upon independence. So at some juncture, the Kurds have to stiffen themselves to deal with the difficulties that will be attached to their decision to have a referendum and to endorse independence.
We're almost out of time here, but a comment from a listener saying some of the Kurds are Turkish nationals and not the PKK. Is that
That's
we were talking
absolutely
about?
True. Indeed, I would say roughly half of Kurdish people do not endorse PKK-backed parties inside Turkey. Some of them are soft Islamists who would support President Erdogan's party. Others would support other parties and might have a lot in sympathy with the PKK, but for historic reasons have disliked that party's monopolistic and dictatorial tendencies.
Or killing of civilians.
Indeed,
or killing
of
civilians as well. Trudy, in our lifetime, is there going to be some kind of a independent Kurdistan or independent-ish Kurdistan in about 15 seconds or less?
I don't think you would have a fully independent Kurdistan in Iraq, but I could see the possibility of a confederation.
Well, thank you all, both of you, for joining us today on Radio Times, helping us understand this alphabet soup of the Kurdish people.
You're very welcome.
Brendan O'Leary, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. He has advised the Kurds in Iraq and will be advising the Kurds in Iraq on their constitution and on statehood as well. Trudy Rubin has traveled to Iraq multiple times, to the Middle East multiple times as well, and she writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Twitter. In fact, we took a little video, a kind of a behind the scenes of Radio Times. You can check it out on our Facebook page. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.